ain't passing through. People are crazy and time's strange. I'm locked in tight, my brain used to care, but things have changed. Walking 40 miles of bad road. The Bible is right, the world will explode. I've been trying to get as far away from myself as I can. Something's too hard to touch, the human mind can only stand so much. You can't win with a losing hand. Feel like falling in love with the first one. Putting in a wheelbarrow and wheeling her down the street. People are crazy and time's a train. Up and tight, my rain. Don't show it. You can hurt someone, not even know it. The next 60 seconds could be an eternity. Gonna get low down, gonna fly high. All the truth in the world adds up to one big lie. In love with a woman who don't even appeal to me. Mr. Jinx and Miss Lucy, they jumped in late. I'm not that eager to make that mistake. My people are crazy and time's strange. I'm locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mike down here in Arizona land. Your mind is your primary weapon. Today is the 19th of November, 2018. It's a Monday, 1918. You're tuned in to Liberty Tree Radio. It's about 4 minutes or so after 9 a.m. Arizona time. Thanks for taking the time to tune in today. And you know that the last half of the year, Liberty Tree Radio is trying to raise funds to pay next year's bill. And if that's achieved, then the bill gets cut in half. So it's important, if you find the information here on Liberty Tree Radio important to you, then it's important for you to help keep Liberty Tree Radio on the air. I have quite a bit of border news, some observations along that aspect of it. Our continuing presentation about the revolt in the desert. It's funny that today is the 19th of 2018, so 1918, and that was the close of World War I. and we're talking about Lawrence and his successful insurgency against the British. It's just a odd lining up of the days and things like that. But anyway, my email address is altabib762@hotmail.com. Those first two words phonetically, it would be Alpha Lima Tango Hotel Alpha Bravo Echo Bravo 762@hotmail.com. A couple of other interesting. Now, the last Friday on the Intel report and the town hall meeting, there was some discussion about the border and things. And then after that was completed, I had turned on the local AM radio station, a big blowtorch here in the Phoenix Valley. It's KFYI, Kilo Foxtrot Yankee India.com. And the talk show host, James T. Harris, was talking about the shooting by an illegal alien, and backtracked it. At KFYI.com on his blog, you have the actual dash cam footage of the shooting. I think it lasted for about 40 seconds. The deputy pulled the car over, well, turned his lights on, and the driver kept going. Then after an extended amount of time, pulled over to the side of the road. Deputy started to exit the vehicle, and about the time his feet hit the ground, Luis Cobos Zenobio exited the vehicle and what appeared to be a Glock handgun and opened fire on the deputy, and then using the vehicle between him and the deputy, changed magazines and moved forward where he's right up by the hood of the deputy's vehicle, and they just were shooting at each other. And backtracking it, it does appear that they actually played it on ABC's Good Morning America, and I guess this happened just last weekend. Now, it was quite a bit to track the article down. Once figured out where the video was, but then there didn't seem to be any print information about it. I checked this one place. It was called the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and they didn't have any listing for it. But then after certain little pieces were found here and there, all of a sudden the article popped up at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. So the guy's name is Luis, L-U-I-S, middle name C-O-B-O-S, and hyphen C-E-N-O-B-I-O. And let's see, so it was in Washington County in Arkansas. And so, I don't know, and I guess looking at the deputy's windshield, person had, he wasn't just blasting, there were about five or six shots in an extremely tight group, and it appears that this person has had some training. Not a whole lot of people that'll engage a target and move forward on that target. They'll, you know, hide behind their vehicle or shoot from out of the window over their shoulder and just spraying and praying. So now I noticed in the Good Morning America article, they did not mention that this was an illegal alien. So, and it wasn't until the second or third article out of this Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette did it say something along the lines of about, and Mr. Canobio has an immigration hold by Immigrations and Customs Enforcement. So I'd like to say thanks for the listener that helped me track some of those down, because it certainly was an exercise in futility, because nobody seemed to know anything about it, and it basically didn't happen. And there was, other than when I first heard the report on KFYI, that they had said that it was an illegal alien, but I had a hard time finding anything in print that actually confirmed that Mr. Cobo Zenobio is an illegal alien. So Arkansas is pretty good distance from the southwest border with Mexico. And now I don't know what the follow-up is. Is it going to turn out that he's a cartel affiliate with that type of pistol marksmanship? Is he a past federale? What the whole story is. Now, I guess because after the shooting, he got back into his car and took off. A short way down the road, he stopped the car and kicked his girlfriend out, and then proceeded on a very long high-speed chase with other municipal police shooting rounds. I think that they said that there was an estimated that all of them had exchanged about 80 rounds during this whole time, that both Mr. Cobo Zenobio and the deputies or the police or whoever. So nothing like having run a gun battle driving down freeways through municipals, et cetera, et cetera. As always, we send this broadcast out to Lily Grace Antoinette, and thank you for the support. Bob Miner, telephone 701-251-2365, 701-251-2365, and you know the drill. Have to key in the first three letters of the last name, 646. Have to wait and follow all the prompts. You're going to have about 7 to 10 seconds to leave a message, and that's just the way it is. Now, I'm not going to go too far into it because we've been talking about Robert Miner, M-I-N-E-R, and since January when all this stuff happens. The telephone number here for Liberty Tree Radio is 712-432-0900, 712-432-0900. Now, when the mechanical voice comes on, you can enter in 957-464, and then the pound sign, 957-464, and the pound sign, and you can listen on your telephone. So if you have things to do and you're not sitting at your computer, then take your telephone and listen to it that way. And then if you'd like to also be part of today's broadcast, you can push *6. We'll unmute you. You can say your piece, and then *6 again will put you back on mute. You'd still be able to listen live on today's broadcast. Got quite a bit of border information. I know I touched on it. That was kind of odd this last weekend, or Friday, actually,'s broadcast. But I'm not going to go into that on today's broadcast. So I guess you'll have to go to the archives and listen to the first 2 hours of the afternoon of the 16th of November, 2018, Friday's broadcast on the issues and things like that that had happened. So when we left off last Monday, continuing our study of the evolution of a revolt from 100 years, well, actually a little bit more, is about 2016. It was all wrapped up by 18. But so the beauty of Lawrence is because there were no books about this stuff, per se, insurgency at the time, because a lot of the thinking about Folk and Jomini, Clausewitz, that you got two opposing armies, you go in here and you either take their stuff and kill the opposing army, or however that was, and there was a certain aspect about it. Now, there are parts in Clausewitz that kind of points in the direction of, you know, things other than conventional war that possibly we could read into it and say that this is insurgency or guerrilla war or however you'd like to categorize it. But still, it was not that definitive. And being that the internal combustion engine and airplanes were just kind of being born at that time, that so not only Lawrence was able to incorporate, he took the Arab raiding party design, and then he modernized it by adding to it what we'd call nowadays as close air support, and with their armored vehicles and supporting machine gun fire to keep the heads of the Turks down while the Arabs rode in on their camels. And they also added mortars to it, high explosives, quite a few things. And at that time, there weren't any books talking about how this was done. Now, somewhere along the lines after Lawrence went in country, he became ill with boils on his bottom from riding a camel and dysentery, and he spent about 10 days in a tent just kind of recovering of what was going on. And he had a lot of time to think. Now, when he was in school at Oxford studying archaeology in his spare time, he had read quite a few other books like Clausewitz on War and The Art of War by Jomini and other people. And so he started calculating in his mind about how the best to carry this insurgency out against the Turks. And he said, well, this guy says this guy says that. Well, that wouldn't work in our deal, and this wouldn't work in that deal. And, you know, we really don't have a standing army, so we can't really enter into battle with them. But then he started doing, dividing it up into the philosophical and the algebraic. And he came to the conclusion that in order for the Turks to occupy all of the area, and it was hundreds of thousands of square miles, that they'd have to have a blockhouse, a fort, about every 4 miles, and it had to be staffed by at least 20 people, and it was way out of the amount of people that the Turks were able to commit to maintaining order and their authority in the Arabian Peninsula. So he knew he had them beat on the algebraic side, and also on the philosophical side, because the Turks were there because they were sent there, not that they wanted to be. And there was a lot of press ganging, if you will, of recruiting or draft of the people and sending them over into the Middle East to maintain their authority over that. And after Lawrence had figured some of these things out, it was kind of like, let's give it a try. But he had gone over and back to Egypt and discussed some of these concepts that he had. And his chiefs didn't really follow all of his arguments, but they did give him leave to try his hand after his own fashion. So the Arabs went off first to Aqaba and took it easily. And then they took Tafila and the Dead Sea, then Azraq and Dara, and finally Damascus. And all in successive stages, worked out consciously when he was in his sickbed. And the process was to set up ladders of tribes, giving them safe and comfortable route from their sea bases in Yenbo, Wedge, and Aqaba, and then on to their advanced bases of operations. Now, sometimes these legs were 300 miles away, and that's a long distance in lands without railroads or roads, but made short by the assiduous cultivation of the desert power and control by camel parties of the desolate and unmapped wilderness, and that fills up all of the center of Arabia from Mecca to Aleppo and Baghdad. Now, in character, the operations were more like naval warfare than ordinary land operations in their mobility and their ubiquity, their independence of bases and communications, and their lack of ground features of strategic areas and of fixed directions or fixed points. Because it's been said that he who commands the sea is at great liberty and may take as much or as little of the war as he will. End quote. Now, he who commands the desert is equally fortunate. Camel riding parties, as self-contained as ships, would cruise without danger along any part of the enemy's land frontier, and that would be just out of sight of his points along the edge of cultivation, and tap or raid into the lines where it seemed fittest or easiest or most profitable, with the sure retreat always behind them into the elements which the Turks could not enter. And so they were fortified in their freedom of movement by an intimate knowledge of the desert front of Syria, and that's a country peculiarly, and historically indefensible against attack from the West. Now, one also thing that, you know, when I mentioned Syria, that the map at that time, it was what they showed as Damascus and the Levant, a kind of like the hinterland or the outback or the wilderness, because that's what it was. There wasn't per se a country called Lebanon or Iraq or Saudi Arabia or Palestine or Israel or Jordan. It was Damascus and the Levant. Now, we've all heard about this ISIL, ISIL. The was Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and the Levant. Well, that's where that word comes from, that it's not a made-up word. It's been around for at least 100 years. It means just, you know, out there. Other than if it was Damascus or somewhere else there in what we call Arabia, then that's what it was. So that it's an important feature, because when we talk about Syria, that it was basically the whole place. So that they had their fortified in their freedom of movement and the knowledge of the desert front of Syria. And it was pretty indefensible against attack from the east. So you'd have to come in from the Persian Gulf side and go across the desert, fat chance. Now, Lawrence, he had traversed most of it on foot before the war many times, working out the movements of Saladin, or Ibrahim Pasha. And as their war experience deepened, they became adept at the form of geographical intuition, described by Borsett as wedding unknown land to known in a mental map. Kind of like what Napoleon would do. Now, the Arabs' tactics were always tip and run, not pushes, but strokes. They never tried to maintain or improve an advantage, but to move off and strike again somewhere else. And they used the smallest force in the quickest time at the furthest place. Now, if the action had continued till the enemy had changed his disposition to resist it, then they would have been breaking the spirit of their fundamental rule of denying him targets. And it was just hit and run, tip and run. Now, the necessary speed in the range they were attained by the extreme fragility of the desert men and their high efficiency when mounted on their she-riding camels. The camel is an intricate animal, and it calls for skilled labor in the handling, but they yield a remarkable return. And they had no system of supply, because each man was self-contained and carried on his saddle from the sea base at which the raid started, 6 weeks' food for himself. Now, the 6 weeks' ration of ordinary men was a half bag of flour, 45 pounds in weight. Now, luxurious feeders carried some rice also for a variety, and each man baked for himself, kneading his own flour in unleavened cakes and warming it on the ashes of the fire. And they carried about a pint of drinking water each, since the camels required to come to the water on average of about every 3 days, and there were no advantage in them being richer than their mounts. Now, some of them never drank between wells, but those were the hardy ones. But most of the people drank a lot at each well and had a drink during the intermediate dry day. Now, in the heat of the summer, Arabian camels will do about 250 miles comfortably between drinks, and that represented 3 days' vigorous marching. The country is not so dry as it is painted, and the radius was always more than they needed, because wells were seldom more than 100 miles apart, and that was an easy day's march. Would have been just 50 miles, and an emergency march might be up to 110 miles in one day. So the 6 weeks' food gave them a range of over 1,000 miles out and back, and that, like the pint of water, was more than ever that they ever needed, even in so large a country as Arabia. Now, it was possible, especially for Lawrence, the camel novice in the army, and painful was a better word, to ride 1,500 miles in a month without resupplying with food, and there was never a fear of starvation because each of them was riding on 200 pounds of potential meat, and when food lacked, they would stop and eat the weakest of their camels. Now, the exhausted camel is poor food, but cheaper killing than a fat one, and they had to remember that their future efficiency depended on the number of good camels at their disposal. So they lived on grazing as they marched, because they never gave them grain or fodder, and after their 6 weeks on the road, they would be worn thin and have to be sent to pasture for some months' rest, while they called out another tribe in replacement or found fresh riding camels. Now, the Arabs did not hamper themselves with led camels. The men carried with them 100 rounds of ammunition and a rifle, or else two men would be an automatic team dividing the gun and the drums of ammunition between them. And they slept as they were in their riding cloaks and fared well enough till the winter of 1917 and 1918, which caught them on a 5,000-foot hill of Edom behind the Red Sea. And then they lost many of the men and the camels frozen to death or trapped in the snow, which lay over all the highlands in deep drifts for weeks, while they vainly appealed to England for tents and boots and blankets. Now, in reply, they were advised that Arabia was a tropical country, and they didn't need that stuff. Now, the equipment for riding parties aimed at simplicity and nevertheless a technical superiority over the Turks in the most critical department. So they had great quantities of light machine guns, but used not as machine guns, but as automatic rifles, snipers' tools, by men kept deliberately in ignorance of their mechanism, so that the speed of action would not be hampered by attempts at repair. Because if a gun jammed, the gunner had to throw it away and go on with his rifle. So they made another special feature of high explosives, and nearly every one of the revolt was qualified by rule of thumb experience in demolition work. And they had also invented special methods of their own for rapid work under fire in the course of the months of practice. And before the end, we're dealing with any quantity of track and bridges economically and safely. Now, on some occasions, they strengthened the tribal raids by armored cars manned by Englishmen. And the armored cars, once they had found a possible track, can keep up with the camel party. They were, however, cumbersome and short range because of the difficulty of carrying fuel, and therefore they seldom used them more than 100 miles from their home base. Now, on the march to Damascus, when they were nearly 400 miles off of the base, they first maintained them by a baggage train of petrol-laden camels, and afterwards, by the use of the Air Force, were able to give them further supplies by a Hadley Page, a type of an aircraft carry over 1,000 pounds of cargo. Now, the cars, the armored vehicles, were a magnificent fighting machines and decisive whenever they came into action on their own conditions. But though each has for a main principle that of fire in movement, but yet the tactical employment of the cars and the camel cars are so different that they don't, Lawrence didn't recommend their being used in joint operations, except in very special circumstances, because they found it demoralizing to both to use armored and unarmored cavalry together. Now, the distribution of the riding parties was unorthodox because it was impossible to mix or combine tribes since they disliked or distrusted one another. And likewise, they could not use the men of one tribe in the territory of the other. And in consequence, they aimed at the wildest distribution of forces. And in order to have the greatest number of raiders on hand at any one time, they added fluidity to their ordinary speed by using one district on Monday, another one on Tuesday, and the third one on Wednesday. And this reinforced their natural mobility because it gave them priceless advantages in pursuit, because the force renewed itself with fresh men in every new tribal area, and they gave them always their pristine energy. Their maximum disorder was, in a real sense, their equilibrium. Now, the internal economy of the raiding parties was equally curious because they aimed at maximum articulation. They were serving a common ideal without tribal emulation, and so they could not hope for any esprit de corps to reinforce their motives. Soldiers are made to a caste either by being given great pay and rewards in money, uniform, or political privilege, or as in England, by being made outcasts, cut off from their fellows by contempt. But Lawrence found that they could not knit men to man, for their tribesmen were in arms willingly by a conviction, and there have been many armies enlisted voluntarily, and there have been a few armies serving voluntary under such trying conditions for so long a war as what went on in the Hejaz, and then any of the Arabs could go home whenever the conviction failed them, or only contract was honored. So consequently, they had no discipline. And in the sense in which it is a restrictive, submergent, or individuality, and the lowest common denominator of men. Now, in regular armies and peace, it means the limit of energy obtainable by everybody present. And it is the hunt, not of an average, but of an absolute, 100% standard in which 99 stronger men are played down to the level of the worst. And the aim is to render the unit a unit and the man a type in order that their effort shall be calculable, but collective output even in gain and in bulk. Now, the deeper the discipline, the lower the individual efficiency, and the more sure the performance. And it's a deliberate sacrifice of capacity in order to reduce the uncertain elements, the bionomic factor in enlisted humanity. And its accomplishment is compound or social war, and that form in which the man in a fighting line has to be the product of the multiplied exertion of the long hierarchy from workshop to supply unit, which maintains him in the field. So the difference was, because the Arab War was simple and individual, every enrolled man served in the line of battle and was self-contained. They had no lines of communications or labor troops. The efficiency of each man was his personal efficiency. They thought that in their condition of warfare, the sum yielded by single men would be at least equal to the product of a compound system. And it was certainly easier to adjust to tribal life and manners, given elasticity and understanding on the part of the commanding officer. Unfortunately for their chances, nearly every young Englishman has the roots of eccentricity in him, and so they got on well enough. Now, of course, they use very few Englishmen in the field, not more than 1 per 1,000 of the Arab troops. Now, a larger portion would have created friction just because they were foreign bodies, pearls, if you please, in the oyster. And those who were present controlled by influence and advice, and that was by their superior knowledge, not by an extraneous authority. As they brought people in that were skilled in using the Lewis gun, or people that were skilled using a mortar or demolitions, and then they would bring them in there to help train the Arabs. Now, in practice, they did not enjoy in the firing line the greater numbers which the adaptation of a simple system put theoretically at their disposal, because they preferred to use them in relay. Otherwise, the attack would have become too extended. So each man had to have liberal workroom. Now, in a regular war, if two men are together, one is being wasted. The moral strain of isolated actions makes that simple form of war very exacting on the individual soldier and demands from him special initiative, endurance, and enthusiasm. Now, their ideal was to make action a series of single combats. Napoleon, in his pregnant valuation of the Marmadukes in terms of the French soldier, first gave Lawrence the idea, Ardent du Pique, widened its application, and prejudices of historians are generally the richest part of their histories. And so what Lawrence came to was that their value depended entirely on quality and not on quantity. So they had to keep always cool, for the excitement of the bloodlust would impair the science of their combatants, and their victory depended on their just use of speed, concealment, and accuracy of fire. an irregular war is far more intellectual than a bayonet charge. Irregular war is far more intellectual than a bayonet charge. Now, it kind of, given the backstory of the thought process of what Lawrence was dealing with, because some of them, when they first show up, were still using muskets. None of them had ever experienced explosives, airplanes, motor vehicles, nothing. They had seen some of these trains, and then they saw some of these armored vehicles and their tenders, and then there would be motorcycles. So in the Arab mind, the locomotive gave birth to the car, and the car, or the armored vehicle, gave birth to the motorcycle. Or when the Hadley Page showed up, which is a pretty good-sized airplane for its day, that it actually gave birth to the smaller biplanes, like, you know, the Sopwith Camel or something along those lines. But that, because they had never experienced those types of machines. Quite interesting. So once again, Lawrence had studied the Arab raiding parties, and all he did was add some components to it, like high explosives, airplanes, armored cars, and didn't try to change anything other than just adding this stuff to it. Like it said that, you know, if there were, each man had to have liberal workroom. In a regular war, if two men are together, one is being wasted. So I'm going to kind of leave that there for our lesson today. And when we get back next Monday, we'll kind of touch on some things. Now, I was able to get to a computer, but for only a very limited time, mentioned on Friday of about the new 2018 national drug threat. And I went through parts and pieces of it rather rapidly. And one part is, you know, we talk about increases, decreases in border activity. Now, this could be one method of a yardstick, if you will, of increased, decreased activity along the southwest border from California to the Rio Grande Valley in Texas. So, and this reflects kilograms of heroin that's been, from comparison between 2016 and 2018. And then there's also the increase, the percentage wise, which we could assume that is a possible increase or a decrease in the overall activity in those areas. And so it's not necessarily about people smuggling or caravans, but has to do with seizures of heroin all along the border, which can generally be translated into increases and decreases in general criminal activity, for what it's worth. So over at the eastern extreme in the Rio Grande Valley, that was 196 kilograms of heroin were seized. So that's a decrease in 24%. Now the next one in the Laredo sector, it had 228 keys seized, so that was a 41% increase. And the next one over in Del Rio, it was 70 kilograms, but that was an increase of 174%. Then Big Bend, 8 kilograms, and that was an increase in 26%. Now in the El Paso sector, and that would include El Paso, Texas, and then all through up to the New Mexico border, only 42 kilos of heroin were seized, and that turns out to be a 2% decrease. Then from the eastern border of Arizona till not quite across the whole state, but that was the seized in the Tucson sector was 444 kilograms, and that was an increase in 3%. But then you jump over to the Yuma sector, which has the western sliver of Arizona and the eastern sliver of California. So that was 101 kilograms, so that was an increase of 104%. And then in El Central in California, 125 keys for a 238% increase. And then in San Diego, it was 1,073 kilograms, and that was an increase in 59%. So generally, all across the border, except for El Paso and the Rio Grande Valley, there's been decreases in drug seizures along there, or heroin seizures, but pretty much everybody else has been from a small 3 to 40%, 20%, some of them up to 170 or 230% increase. So all in all, it looks like, not that we didn't know that, but quite a bit of increase. Now, I have some other news items, but these ones are from, well, that I touched on this on Friday, and it's kind of out of sync, but it has to do with, it's a from Borderland Beat from 13 October. But since El Chapo's trial is going on, found it quite interesting. I know that there were a few news outlets that mentioned that it was starting, and there was something about El Chapo had a motion because he wanted to give his wife a hug before the trial started, and somebody else wanted his autograph. But I noticed that nobody seems to want to cover in the testimony. So BorderlandBeat.com, 14 November 2018, El Chapo trial, day two. EPN and Fox were on the payroll. And that's Enrique Peña Nieto, the current president of Mexico. Now, today, prosecutors requested Judge Kogan throw out the opening statements of the defense. Reasons given is that the defense strayed from speaking solely about evidence that will be presented in trial. And Judge Kogan reprimanded the defense without throwing out opening statements of the defense. A point of contention was the presidents of Mexico were on the cartel payroll. The prosecution filed a motion overnight demanding that the judge, Brian M. Kogan, strike the entire statement from the record, calling it rife with impropriety and based on blatantly inadmissible hearsay. Said Lichtman, I think that's one of the lawyers, this is a case that will require you to dismiss what you were taught to believe in about the way government works and how they behave, he continued. This is a case which will require you to open your minds to the possibility that government officials at the very highest level can be bribed, but can conspire to commit horrible crimes. The American law enforcement agents can also be crooked. Now, while the world focused on this mythical Chapo figure, the world is not focusing on Mayo Zambada. And that's thanks to hundreds of millions of dollars in bribes paid to Enrique Peña Nieto, the current president of Mexico, and his predecessor, Vicente Fox. Mr. Lichtman said that Zambada had been left free because he bribes the entire government of Mexico, including up to the very top, the current president of Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto. Judge Kogan said defense went far afield of direct or circumstantial proof. Now, here's another one. The BorderlandBeat.com, 14 November 2018, El Chapo trial. Jesus El Rey Zambada, brother of El Mayo, testifies as a cooperative witness. Jesus Zambada, brother of Ishmael El Mayo Zambada, took the stand in the trial of El Chapo this afternoon as a cooperative witness and pointed out El Chapo as one of the leaders of the Sinaloa cartel. Zambada gave testimony affirming that El Chapo operated the cartel with his brother El Mayo. He testified that he began his cartel career as an accountant. He also stated that before his 2008 arrest, he was a Sinaloa cartel lieutenant, describing his role as a cartel as the leader in Mexico City. He claims that El Chapo operated a staging warehouse in Mexico City as a stopping point for cocaine flowing from Colombia, further stating that the cartel controlled the airport in Mexico City, paying off the government to conduct business untouched. Interesting, the statement about paying off the government, because that was a point of contention by prosecutors when the defense attorney, Lichtman, made the statement in his opening argument. And that morning, Lichtman attempted to explain away the infamous Sean Penn El Chapo video, saying it was all about vanity when Chapo said he was the Sinaloa cartel leader. He was aiming for a book and film about himself. Let's see, we still have about 7 minutes or so before the top of the hour. One more here, BorderlandBeat.com, November 15, 2018, more Sinaloa cartel heroin in Northern California. Now, let's see, Drug Task Force intercepts nearly 2 pounds of heroin plus $32,000 in cash in Eureka, California. November 1, a post entitled Humboldt County Largest Heroin Bust. Okay, I made a note that while Borderline Beat so used to reading about the hundreds or thousands of kilos busted, they remember that the shipments were meant to be delivered to hubs, and these were the kind of small busts that are insidious to small communities, especially small rural communities all over the country. And these are the drugs that the people that are hard at work doing the cartel business and feeding the ever-growing heroin, meth, cocaine, and fentanyl-laced drugs, and that so ruins the lives and the families and the entire communities. And this is just one example. The latest biggest bust netted 4 pounds of heroin, $35,000, guns, and 3 Mexican nationals that were arrested. Now, in a press release from the Humboldt County Drug Task Force, and that's the HCDTF, the information has not been proven in a court of law, and any individuals described should be presumed innocent until proven guilty. Now, on November 13, 2018, at approximately 2:30 p.m., special agents with the Humboldt County Drug Task Force, with the assistance of a narcotic detection canine from the Humboldt County District Attorney's Office, served the search warrant at the motel located in the 4,000 block of Broadway in Eureka. Now, agents previously received information that Jaime La Varga Nava, age 29, from Sinaloa, Mexico, is a member of a drug trafficking organization who, and that's it's a 10-page article, and that was just page one. And so if you want to know more about this, well, we might call it a pretty insignificant because it's only 2 pounds, $32,000 in cash, 3 illegals. But that's just a tad bit on some of those items. Now, I try to keep these things running in a chronological or time fashion, try to cover the oldest ones first and then move forward so we don't have a whole bunch of news that's presented way out of date. Now, the interesting part on this one from Borderland Beat, it's dated the 13th of October, 2018, so it's about a month old. Now, they make it a big deal about this quote-unquote rocket launcher, but it's from an AT-4, and AT-4, kind of like the M72A2 Law rocket, it's a fire-and-forget weapon. You can't, like, really reload it. So just because somebody had an empty rocket launch tube, but then again, when they're playing up to the average citizen that doesn't know the difference between, then they can easily slide one of these stories past. But the BorderlandBeat.com, 13 October 2018, California coyotes caught with migrants, drugs, and arsenal. California, the United States, two alleged poleros, eight undocumented persons, and an arsenal that included a missile launcher were secured by elements of the Border Patrol in a house located in El Centro in Imperial County, California. The address is located approximately 18 kilometers north of the border. Now, it was during a search by the U.S. border authorities that they managed to locate the alleged poleros, or coyotes, i.e. human smugglers, who were paid to help migrants cross into the U.S. illegally, and the two men were 50 and 28 years old, both of whom are United States nationals. They were located and secured five rifles, four short firearms, and one missile launcher, along with 3.75 grams of methamphetamine, drug paraphernalia, body armor, and just over $5,300 in cash. So it transpired that the 28-year-old suspect is linked by U.S. authorities as a member of a gang in Calexico, California, and the undocumented eight people will remain detained in order to testify as witnesses in the trial of the probable poleros. And some of this also kind of touches on where we've been before. We were discussed that Fox News deal about all these people over in Yuma County jumping over the fence there. But the human smugglers in recent weeks have been abandoning large groups of Guatemalans and other migrant Central Americans in the Sonora Desert, surrounded by cactus near the Mexican border. Alarmed officials of the Border Patrol who say the trend is putting hundreds of children at risk. Altogether, more than 1,400 migrants have been left by smugglers in the burning heat or in the case in the midst of a severe storm in the remote areas on the border since August 20. One group was no less than 275 people. Large groups never on this scale. Tucson-based Border Patrol agent Daniel Hernandez, it's definitely a serious concern because your safety is being compromised. Hernandez said the latest case involved 61 people rescued by agents last week from rising floods caused by unusually heavy rains in an isolated area and could have been a much worse situation in case the rain continued. Unlike Texas, where people surrender on the banks of the Rio Grande, smugglers in Arizona have been throwing groups of migrant families on the remote dirt road that runs along the southern limit of the Oregon Pike National Monument to the west of Loopville border crossing with Mexico. The migrants are sometimes given food and water, but not always, and often require medical care for back and ankle injuries or lacerations. Trackers do not take into account the safety and the well-being of the families, and the Tucson sector, Rodolfo Carich, said last week, two large groups of migrants from Guatemala and Honduras were also found abandoned last week near Yuma. Border Patrol officials said 108 people were found just before midnight on October 2, a half a mile west of the San Luis port of entry, and 5 hours later, agents detained 56 Central Americans 1 mile east of the border crossing. So that's, and it does continue. An agent of the U.S. Border Patrol and the international border separating Sonora, Mexico, and Lukeville, Arizona, while Mexican men traveling with their relatives have always made up the bulk of the migrants, Guatemalans and other Central Americans who travel in families or as unaccompanied minors, are now the norm. Well, that music signals the end of today's broadcast, so we're going to join together with the band, and we're going to get it done, get her done, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for being with us today on Liberty Tree Radio, and please help keep the network on the air. I'll see you next Thursday over on the Micro Effect. Same bat time, same bat station. Thanks.